Okay, so in our last year, we began discussing the topic of negative theology, in general, not only the Rambam. The Rambam, I think I mentioned, is certainly not the only one who has a negative theology. Just remember what negative theology is. Negative theology is the assertion which states that one cannot say anything about what God is, God's essence. All we can say about God is what God is not. Now, one second. Now, you might say, now there are a number of Rishonim who feel, in generally, that you can agree with the Rambam and say we cannot say anything about what God is, right? But we can say something about his actions or how he is in relationship or, what's the third one I'm missing here? Actions, relations, and... No, remember? One second.
There are five.
No, the two of them are related to the essential. And there are three what he calls accidental qualities. So some are moral attributes, right, in terms of like... what examples he gives? Either a color or a taste, it can be more that sense, or alternatively, certain affections, that's it, right? There's their affections, there are relations, and then there are, there's relative attributes, and then there are actions. And the number of Rishonim who feel that one can speak about God in those terms. Right, the Kuzari, for example, thinks that one can speak about God in relative terms because he's greater. And it's true that God is greater not only in degree but in kind. But nonetheless, you can still speak about him in that manner and not harm his notion, right, of his oneness. And the Rambam absolutely disagrees. And the Rambam says the only thing we can say about God is what God is not, or depict his actions. And even when we're talking about his actions, let's just recall, the attributes of his actions are basically, you can say, the consequence of his actions. Meaning, you can make a statement and say that because of God, X, Y, and Z happened. There's a consequence. But you cannot derive, because of what his actions, something about his nature. That cannot be stated. You can only say the consequence of his actions. Okay? Now, there's a problem with this assertion. What's the obvious problem with this assertion?
The Torah
seems to attribute all the time affections, relativity, and certain actions, or it might be.
Explained that.
Huh?
He already explained that.
Well, he starts getting into this. What do you mean, already explained it?
And he mentioned already.
Oh, meaning when he got into the issue of corporealism, he had to address this. And in 153, he does the same thing. And he says, right, in the beginning of 153, and says, the reason why people believe in the existence of the attributes are akin to those why people believe in the doctrine of his corporeality. Namely, what makes people apikorsim? The Bible. Tanakh. Tanakh is the biggest source of leading people to apikorsis. Huh? That's what I'm going to learn Gemara. No. But he can't say that. Because as we've seen, he thinks, well,
the Gemara
might lead people astray as well sometimes. Although, as we saw, the Rambam asserts very clearly with regard to corporealism, Chas v'shalom, to think that any Maimon Chazal believe in God's corporeality. Okay, I think I mentioned to you that the Rid's grandson, right? Well, the Italian Rishonim, says that one of the reasons why people believe in God's corporeality is that there's a few Maimon Chazal that assert that such. I mean, there are a few figures in the Chal that believe that, but they're wrong. I mean, he thinks they're wrong, but he actually thinks that a few Maimon Chazal imply such thing. The Rambam doesn't believe in that. Okay? Of course, we also saw a number of Rishonim who actually just believe that God has some form of corporeality. What he said?
The Bible, it's you reading it all, not believing it. It's all you're learning too much philosophy.
Yeah, that's a famous girl with regard to demons and other things and whatever it might be. And angels, and we discussed a little bit when we did 149, we did angels, I figured mention that. Well, we'll come back to that, Gaurav. I think maybe 2 weeks we'll take a step back and try to sort of sum up the first part of the guide that we've seen, and we'll address some of the criticism of the Rambam then, hopefully. Okay, in any case, so 153 says, and here once again he launches the classic line of Dibra Torah Kalashim Bnei Adam. He says that in 153. He also says that, if I'm not mistaken, in 159. Yes, in 159 as well. We'll come back to 159 a little bit later on, because that's very interesting. And he has actually a very interesting analogy that he makes to try to explain, even though, one second, before we get to the analogy, what he basically says here is, any attribute, I'm in 153 on page 121 in the penis version here, he says, it accordingly should not be regarded as inadmissible reference to God made magnified and honored. The diverse actions proceeded from one simple essence. Okay, there's no multiplicity. And every attribute, here's the point about Tanakh, that is found in the books of the deity, Tanakh, may be exalted, is therefore an attribute of his action and not an attribute of his essence. Okay? Every single thing. It might sound like it's talking about what God is, but it's not. Okay? Now, the obvious, by the way, now what's interesting is as follows. In 154, we'll come back to that momentarily, 153. But in 154, and here's just one of these classic, you know, moves, which I have no doubt is, I mean this seriously, is genuine. It's just a classic philosophical move. Who, of course, is the one who is taught that we cannot know anything about God's essence, but only about his actions? Moshe Rabbeinu, right? In 154, he interprets Shmo Perek Lame Gimel, right, when God says, etc., right, and the whole sipur there, he basically understands he has two requests. One is to know his essence, one is to know his attributes. God says to him, my essence cannot be known, my attributes can be known. Okay? Now, my attributes in the sense of my actions, right, can be known. Okay? By the way, I was learning this with my daughter, Kita Gimel, is currently learning Shmuel Perek Lama Gimel, and I was going through this, so I said to her, so Gila, you see what God said? God says his essence can't be known, but he can be known through negative theology as well as through his attributes of his actions. She's like, what? I'm like, just kidding. She had no idea what I was talking about. That's what happens when your father is a little bit too philosophical. In any case, hopefully she won't be scarred from that experience later on in life, you know? Anyway.
Or from the American Bat Mitzvah.
Or from the American Bat Mitzvah, yes. Which one's more likely, I'm not sure. Anyway, now, it is obvious, of course, to anyone that in Shmot Lame Gimel is the obvious kasha on the Rambam, namely, Shmot Lame Gimel seems to tell us not relative attributes, not his actions, but namely his attributes. Not his essence, his attributes, right? You Gimel Midot. That's what it means, right? So, of course, the Rambam has an answer to that question. Right? And what does he say? He says, according to the apprehension of these actions is an apprehension of his attributes may be exalted. The proof of the assertion that the thing where he says it is what? Is the fact that what has been made known to him were simply pure attributes of action. Merciful and gracious, long-suffering, etc. These are the derachim. These are the ways. Okay? The meaning here is not that he possesses moral qualities. Of course, you say, well, that's not a proof. Hafuch. That means he has moral qualities. No. But that he performs actions resembling the actions that in us proceed from moral qualities. I mean from aptitudes of the soul. The meaning is not that he may be exalted, possesses aptitudes of the soul.
The way we interpret
that's
that.
Right, that's
so
right. In other words,
doing things and we say, oh, God was merciful.
Oh, that's correct. In other words, this is a consequence, but in other words, these are actions which are of the type of people, which in people we would think are what? Merciful people, rachum, rachanun, etc. But then that's not what the Torah is actually saying about God. It's just saying he performs the actions. or the consequence of him, are certain actions which, had we been attributing certain traits to an entity or human, based on these actions, we've gotten to these types of attributes.
Why does he feel this? Why does the Rambam feel that's so?
Oh, there is so. Why does he feel this is so important?
Yeah, but why does he feel that's the reason? Why couldn't it be there? Why couldn't we say that?
Because the Rambam feels, and the Rambam's definition of what God is that anything, any type of statement which says an attribute of something implies that this attribute is tied to something else. And he says that just can't be, because then you're talking about some form of separation. Now, it's interesting, what is the key of the Rambam? I mean, partly what the Rambam cares about here is God's unity. There's no doubt about that, meaning it's saying his definition. But part and parcel what I think the Rambam really wants to get to is that God's unity is reflective of his uniqueness. Meaning, what God is nothing which is comparable in degree. And as soon as you start talking about attributes, right, then you start thinking about him, is Kobe's really merciful. God is really merciful. But you're already talking with those same type of language, which the Rambam is very concerned about.
And God becomes something you can't define, and if you begin to define him, that's already there.
That's right. Right? Now, if there's in question, meaning, is the issue for the Rambam that he's afraid of, like, sort of the slippery slope, once you start talking about it, you'll lead to it? Or is it just in its own right, Kfira? I think the answer is the latter, meaning the Rambam thinks that it's probably, there's no doubt the Rambam was afraid that this will lead to thinking about God in a heretical manner, but it also seems to me the Rambam just felt that was outright wrong. It's the wrong definition of God. Okay? Now, the only thing that's different about this and corporeality is as follows. With regard to corporeality, he thinks that's a simple concept that can be understood and taught to the masses. This, he admits, is not a simple concept. Right? But he nonetheless says, you know, it's not because it's belief. Okay. Now, what is interesting is as follows. The Rambam is a very interesting...
It's interesting that the Rambam would think that part of the nature, part of the fact about God is that we can't understand him, and therefore the simple person is by nature... And Apicorus doesn't understand God. So what's
unfair?
It's like, is it not even unfair? It's like the Rambam has this idea of God that God really isn't meant for everyone.
So we did this. We discussed this a little bit. I mean, but when we talked about Kfir Bishogek, when we said the Rambam, there are others who say if you don't intend to be kofar, just happen to believe in God having a body, okay, you know, God is moicha, so to speak, right? We're led astray by the Tanakh. The Rambam doesn't have any concept of kofar b'shogeg. A kofar is a kofar. In other words, you're saying, yeah, but that's not fair? The answer is, okay. The Rambam's an elitist. There's no way of getting around this. And when we get to 351, you can jump ahead if you want, take a look, the Rambam has this famous analogy of the palace. Right? And that God is in inner chambers, and who getting closer here? And the people that are from, and like Talmudic scholars, I mean, he says it's more or less, halachic scholars, are outside the palace. Unless you've got philosophical training, you're outside. I mean, that's why they burned the book. I'm saying, I mean, that's one of the reasons. I'm saying, but that's why, in other words, and every time you hear about people, you know, about Torah, Mada, all these other things, like, you know, people feel like they're justified. You should understand. Not for the Rambam, not only for the Rambam. For the strong, you know, medieval rationalist philosophers, whatever it might be, people without serious philosophical training are just missing a serious element of the Avodas Hashem. And it's not because, you know, they need a college degree so they can, you know, work at Lehman Brothers or...
No, but it's not like that. I mean, it's even the ones who are them delving into Machshava, they're not in line with his.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt about it. There's no doubt. Yeah, sometimes it's even worse off for you, right? There is, if you're not qualified, you can even be further outside the palace. But there's no getting way around it. I mean, I admit, this is an interesting question, because at some point, one of the things you have to ask yourself as you keep on reading this, there's sort of two questions. One is, what is God here? Meaning, what is this entity that we're praying to and all these other things, and how does God intervene in the world? I mean, this is a really transcendent God. That's one question which we'll address directly. And the second question relates to the limits of human knowledge. I think at some point, the Rambam is so, makes such a transcendent God, then it comes to the point where one might think, you know, this is ridiculous. I can't know anything about God, and therefore forget all of this intellectualism, because there are such great limits to human knowledge, all I can really do are mitzvot and actions. And there's a very interesting question that there's sort of two different, you could call it, two different endings to the guide of the Mora. 351 and 354. I mean, 354 is literally the last chapter. And 51 is an analogy of the palace, but then it keeps on going. And then there's a question, well, what exactly is the relationship between these two endings when it gets into the importance of ethical actions and whatnot? Okay? But keep those two questions in mind, because, A, what is this God? And B, what is the purpose of knowing God if you really don't know much of God? Right. Now, the Rambam is an interesting analogy here, by the way, to explain, to make this idea 153. He compares it to a fire. And he says as follows. If you, based on the actions of a fire, what do you mean the actions of the fire? The consequences of a fire. What would you see? What does a fire do? Well, some things it makes hard, something cooks and burns, some things it bleaches, some things it blackens, right? There's all sorts of, a fire has all sorts of effects. And you might say, therefore, that fire is, right, multiple things, because it does all things. But what is all of this? Just heat. And heat impacts, right, different objects in different ways. So the Rambam says the same thing about God, meaning there's just one simplicity to it, okay, which has all sorts of consequences and effects, but it's one entity. Now the difference, of course, between fire and God is that fire, you can say, has an essential quality to it, at least the way it impacts them, the heat. Okay? Whereas, with regards to God, you can't say that. Okay, but he's just trying to get you to understand, right, that there doesn't have to be, because something can have multiple consequences in the realm of action, doesn't say that there's any multiplicity to it. That's one of the reasons why he allows for us to say something about God's actions. Questions?
Yeah, I don't know how we could say that then, if it's not applicably connected to each at all then, because all of the actions are different, and all of the effects of it are different. It's not like fire at all. I don't see how it's like fire.
Yeah, I mean, part of the problem, which you say back to the Rambam, I mean, the Rambam is just trying to give you an analogy of understanding why attributes per se, attributing consequences to actions, not attributes, acts, right, doesn't imply inherently multiplicity. Okay? Now, you're right, and this is what he's afraid of. He's afraid of people saying, yeah, but God does so many things. Right? And he's saying to you, correct. So we have to understand that you cannot, just because the consequences of his actions you can talk about, you cannot from there derive attributes.
It sounds like you would be saying that it has to do with all these things that are what comes out of the action.
It's generally the same entity at the time. Same entity. But not that there is different. You can't say that about God. You can't say there are different attributes or actions. You can't say that. Now everyone agrees with him, by the way. Rav Chastai Kreska seems to say, although before him it seems to be Yosef Albo's teacher. Rav Chastai Kreska seems to change his mind a little bit along the way. Am I getting confused here? Is it Rav Yosef Albo? I think it's Rav Yosef Albo says this. Bishop Yosef Albo disagrees with the Rambam. Or is it the Rav Bag? I'm getting confused right now. I'm getting confused. One of them. I think it's the Rav Bag. The Rabbag, sorry. Yes. Can't be right. I'll look it up. Anyway, one of them says, the Rambam's wrong. Right? You can speak about God in positive terms, and this is all some form of name game. This is all just semantics. Because what does it mean when you say that God is not X? That God does not have a certain privation, right? That God is not missing something. What are you basically saying? That God has something. Meaning, not X.
Finding it by what it is.
Right? Not X equals Right? And the Rambam is a response to this. It's sort of a question of, you know, whether you like this or not. But the Rambam's basic answer to this in 158 is basically to say as follows. You think that this is show, but it's not so. And I'll explain to you why. When you say it in the negative formulation, the whole point of saying it in the negative formulation is to stress the fact, don't do the reverse in the logical equation. Because all you, what you're trying to say is, God doesn't have this privation, right? Meaning, you can say God has no lack of knowledge. So that sounds like you're saying God is all-knowing. But the whole point of saying it in that formulation is to say, I cannot say what God is, but I can say what God is not. That's the whole point. Okay, and that's his argument in 158. Now, you could argue back and say, Rambam, this is just semantics. The Rambam doesn't think this is semantics. The Rambam thinks this is critical, though. Because every time you say what God is not, you're affirming that you cannot say what God is. Now, the question becomes, what's the point? And for the Rambam, though, this is a big deal. In 159, the Rambam says as follows. If there is no device leading to the apprehension of the true reality of his essence, in what respect can there be superiority and inferiority between those who apprehend him? Now, this is obviously the question. No one can know what God is. What's the difference between those who don't know what God is and those who don't know what God is? In other words, at the end of the day, whether you're, you know, an imbecile, right, in terms of your philosophical knowledge, or you're the greatest philosopher in the world, you just don't know what God is.
What would be the Rambam's opinion on like saying Kibiyachol, you said, like saying God is all-knowing Kibiyachol?
Well, I mean, the Rambam obviously has that notion, because who's the greatest Kibiyachol writer? No, Moshe Rabbeinu, right? Torah, right? In other words, right? Kibiyachol, right? In other words, basically, the Rambam just thinks you should add the word Kibiyachol, like, throughout, like, Tanakh. Right? In other words, that would make the Rambam's life a lot easier if they just done that. But what the Rambam is basically saying is just, at the beginning of every Torah, write Kibiyachol. I mean, not every...
No, because that's what the Tanya does, for example. Every time a person would action or thing, either uses mamash, which means you can define it as it. Mamash means you can actually define that, or it says kibiyachol.
Right, so... I mean, that's part of this influence on the Rambam, negative theology, but the Rambam would be very nervous about that, because the Rambam doesn't want people talking that way. Because there are a couple of things here. I mean, one of the, like I said, as soon as you start talking that language, which is a pedagogical tool, but it inherently is going to lead people to go down the wrong, it's a dangerous pedagogical tool, basically. And it's going to lead people to think that God is different in degree and not different in kind. Okay. Now remember, part of the reason why the Rambam insists on God's unity and says you can't attribute this is says that any form of attribute has to have been created. But God was the first creator. There's nothing that God's created. So you cannot say anything about God's essence. Because an essence, what is an essence? An essence is the character which defines you at your creation. Human beings are defined by their intelligence. Say fire by its property of heat, whatever it might be. Okay? But since God was never created, therefore there's nothing that defines his essence. That's why God can't have it, and that's part of the reasons why God. He makes that point in 157. 157? Yeah, 157. Right? And that is so this is part of where he started to get to what God is, his definition of God. Of saying only God has no cause for his existence, and therefore God's existence is necessary to the world for anything to have happened. And we'll get into this more when we get to the proofs of God's existence. Okay, how are we doing? But basically, 156, again, and you can see 156 is very good. Because 156 where the Rambam really stresses there's no likeness between man and God. Okay? And it's clear he has a mind. I mean, basically says if God has attributes, you're basically turning God into Zeus. Bigger, stronger version of humans. Now, by the way, I don't know if I think I mentioned this last time, but I want to stress this as well. The modern day, I mean by in the modern era, I don't mean contemporary, critics of religion, right? One of the things that they criticize religion for is that how do they know that religion is sort of this imaginary thing, the God doesn't exist? What is religion? Religion is just human beings imposing some form of greater form of them, right, on the world, so to speak, in order to explain how the world works. Okay?
Psychological projection.
That's right. That's right. Okay? And why do they do that? Because it helps them give explanation for what the world is. Okay? And there are many who made such claims along the way. I think the most interesting one is someone by the name of Ludwig Feuerbach. Right? Feuerbach has a big... he's sort of the great apocryphon of the modern era.
Sounds very Jewish.
German.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken. Ludwig Feuerbach, if I'm not mistaken. I think it's German.
Yeah, Ludwig's definitely German.
I think that's his name. But anyway, I forget his first name now. Feuerbach, yeah. Anyway, I think it's in Ludwig. Anyway, and that's, by the way, where Marx gets his things from. In other words, what Marx does, when Marx writes his original Opium of the Masses, Marx doesn't talk about religion that much, actually. People think about it, is. But his, what he talks about Opium of the Masses is his theses on Feuerbach, meaning he's writing about Feuerbach. And the, what Marx is doing is saying that the, what was your term?
Psychological projection.
I'm not sure if that's exactly the term he used, but you get the idea, right? Psychological projection was used in a manner to explain certain socioeconomic subjugation.
And control.
That's right. In other words, he just went further than Feuerbach to say that the religion is used as a vehicle to explain the class distinctions and then therefore to subjugate humans. So everyone knows that concept from Marx, right? And that's sort of one of these famous concepts, and Marx applies it to many things, not just to religion. And many, whether it's human rights or other forms of government and democracy, whatever it might be, and he thinks it's just the ways of systems of subjugating people. Okay, but when he talks about religion, he's getting us from Feuerbach. Whereas Feuerbach said this is a super imposition for humans to feel good about the world, and they project this existence of this God doesn't exist. Okay, now why am I mentioning this right now?
Because the Roman goes exactly the opposite direction.
In what sense?
God is nothing like any human.
Right, but there is, what the Rambam is, it knows very well. You're correct. There is, in some ways, the Rambam, his definition of God, is undermining that challenge in the following sense. Right? Because he's basically saying that we just don't know what God is. Right? Now, Feuerbach, I think, that's not what the Rambam does it. Right? But one of the things that the Rambam is trying to do, for his own reasons, is to make sure human beings don't think that. Not because he's worried about Feuerbach, but because he's worried about Avodah Zarah. I suspect Feuerbach would say, well, whatever the Rambam, whatever reasons he did for philosophy, that's exactly what human beings do with regard to religion. Human beings are doing exactly what the Rambam fears, says not to do, and many other philosophers, but that's exactly what they do, and they do it for these reasons. All I'm just saying is that the projection, the superimposition of humans into God, the projection, psychological projection, if you will, right, is a common concept of a fear of, and there's in sociology of religion, of thinking about religion as a whole. Okay? And the Rambam, in many ways, gets us out of that problem. Of course, what the Rambam's also done is created a tremendously transcendent God. He's out there. About whom we know very little, and frankly, not only do we know very little, we can say very little.
How does the Rambam, that's a big question, probably, how does the Rambam define the concept of, like, said, man being created in the image of God and all of this?
Oh, so we saw this in 1:1. Notice the image of God is a reference to knowledge, the image of God refers to, but it's only the way that people talk about God as being all-knowing. So that was the analogy made to say that what? Humans are are defined by their essence of knowledge. But that God, right, actually can be defined by his knowledge, because that we can't say. If you take a look back at 1:1, the very end of 1:1, the Rama makes this point, because if you read 1:1 and then you just like skipped everything in the middle and then come to this, you're like, hey, wait a minute. He just said, Nasa Damasil Minikin Matina, God's essence is what? Is knowledge. So here, where is this? At 1-1, on page 23, previous version, he says, by the way, not that God may be exalted is a body and possesses a shape. Well, he says as follows. 1 second. No. Oh, yeah. He says, when we think about this, although in reality is not like the latter apprehension, meaning God isn't really like that, but the Torah used the term because it knows that human beings think about God as all-knowing, and therefore they use that term to explain that human beings are defined by their knowledge, even though God, we can't say about God that he's all-knowing. There's a pedagogy. That's right. There's no. Both the Rambam himself uses the technique of contradictions. He tells us this fifth contradiction, right in the introduction, as a pedagogical tool in order to get us to understand something. So we understand human beings, say something about God that as he moves along, he's going to change what he says about God. That's 100%. Pedagogical development. So.
But that does not undermine the concept of Sedomayokin.
Correct. It doesn't undermine.
It does or does not?
Does not.
Why not? If he's saying the concept of Sedem Elokim was for us to be able to define ourselves
because
through our knowledge based on the fact that
because it's only that which God. People think but about God at first glance, even though you don't know anything about God. I understand what you're bothering you. What you're bothering you is you're saying there's all these self-referential terms, or referential terms, excuse me, in the Torah, which is now undermining. So he's okay with that. Again, that's what the Rambam thinks different. Saying that's what the Rambam thinks is, no, he's saying there's no excuse for that. That's why I have my shir, meaning, and if you didn't show up to any shirim of mine or make it up in the middle, you can't even do shogi anymore. Meaning, this was a dangerous shir to come to. Understand? Jens? Oh, so this is 159. This is what I want to highlight to you. This is the question we just started. We got to then, we took a, we're coming back for a second. 159 starts off and says, what's the difference between the person who doesn't know because he's ignoramus and the person who doesn't know because he's a great philosopher? Right? And then you might say, oh, then what's the point of doing this? So he says as follows. If, however, there's none, Moshe Rabbeinu and Shlomo did not apprehend anything different from what a single individual among the people's apprehends, and there can be no increase in this knowledge. In other words, what he's basically saying is, what did Moshe and Shlomo, supposed to be these grand geniuses, comprehend that was worthwhile?
It's a similar like mathematical question. If just to know God isn't requires an infinite knowledge, so what does a million make a difference to one?
Right.
And you're never making progress.
Right. Precisely. So here he says as follows. Now, it's generally accepted by the men of the law, nay, even by the philosophers, that there exist numerous differences of degree in this respect. Know, therefore, that this is indeed so, and that the difference of degree between those who apprehend are very great indeed. For the thing of which attributes are predicated becomes more particularized with every increase in attributes that are predicated of it, and he who predicates these attributes accordingly comes nearer to the apprehension of the true reality of the thing in question. In a similar way, in other words, the more attributes in general you know of something, so if you don't have perfect knowledge of it, you have a much better understanding of what it is. Okay, now let me give you an example. Let's say a black hole, whatever it might be. Okay, certain scientific concepts, a scientific phenomenon. So we know some things about these scientific phenomena, let's say these astronomical phenomena, but don't know everything about it. But the more we know, or the more a person comprehends, you could say that a person is more knowledgeable of what that thing is.
This whole point is that you can't know anything.
Yeah. Well, one second. Before I get there. And therefore, the same thing is true as well. In a similar way, you come nearer to the apprehension of him, may he be exalted, with every increase in the negations regarding him. And you come nearer to the apprehension that he who does not negate with regard to him that which, according to what has been demonstrated to you, must be negated. In other words, the Rambam's argument says, the more you know how much you don't know, the more you know.
That's from Kabbalah. The more you study Hakadosh Baruch Hu, the more you begin to realize how much you understand.
Yes, but then that makes you smarter. Meaning, but don't quote me a famous Rambam. It's just because in yeshivas they don't learn the Rambam. Go on. I'm saying, but go home, Ramchal. You know what I'm saying? In other words, like, really. You can stay. I mean, literally, I'm just saying. In other words, the Rambam, right? Now, this is his argument. It's saying the more that you understand what you can and cannot say about God, right, the stronger. Now, what is interesting is as follows. There's a pasuk. Is there a Tanakh here? There must be a Tanakh here somewhere. No, we have Tanakh here because it turns me with Avikoros. There's a Ramchal, though. Anyway, okay. So if you take a look, there's this famous pasuk at the Tehillim. Samech. Oh my God, I'm going the wrong direction. Is this Tanakh missing something? Okay. The pasuk says, Lamaseach Mizmor David Shir, right? Perek Samechay of Tehillim. Lecha dimiya tihila Elohim b'tzion lecha yushulam neder. So the Rambam gets rid of this whole second thing. What's the Rambam says? Silence is praise to thee. Very clear that's the way they break down this pasuk anyway. But what the Rambam basically says, we are dazzled by God's beauty. Right? We are dazzled about that which we cannot know about God. And therefore, in many ways, what is the best thing to say about God? Nothing. Okay? Now, what's the problem of saying nothing about God? You won't know anything about God. Then God gets lost. And here, then, in 159... the Rambam explains the famous Maimer Chazal, Brochos Daf Lamed Gimel, which talks about, after all, we do describe God in our tefillah, right? So remember, there's this famous story where the student just keeps on going on and going on, and it's right, and he uses all these other descriptions of attributes of God, right? He leaves the Nusach. Remember the story? Remember you guys like this Brochos? And the Gemara then says, Rabbi Chanina listens to the guy and says to him, the guy after like 2 minutes stops and he says, what, you're done? Meaning, once you keep on going, there's nowhere to stop. And therefore, all you can say about God is that which you are allowed to say about God. Which Chazal in their wisdom declared in a certain tefillah, which is what we state, right, is what we state. But anything more beyond that, in which you state, right, is heretical, because you really shouldn't be saying anything about God. Just, we have to say something about God to have a sense of what we don't know about God. And therefore, Chazal has to say one thing, but we can't say anything more. And of course, Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, when they enacted the tefillah, only meant it in terms of Dibur Torah Kol Hashem Ne'odom. Right, when it says Atagi Bor, right, all these other things, which is Dibur Torah Kol Hashem Le'Adam, which of course, in generally speaking as well, is only a description of his actions in this world.
If the Rambam is so certain that you can only define God as what he's not, why has no one ever done that before him? Like Tanakh, there's no like negative descriptions of God. Chazal don't know.
The Rambam says Dibur Torah Kol Hashem Le'Adam. There's a pedagogical need for it.
But the way of describing God is what he is not. So, one's done it before. Like,
this is the grand critique of the Rambam. Anyone who adopts negative theology, but certainly of the Rambam, who basically say, listen, the God that you're describing here is not the God of Tanakh. Okay? And the God of Tanakh, there's a religious experience. Okay? And negative theology is, that's not the theology of Tanakh. The analogy is sometimes people formulate it as, I'm not so comfortable with this, but basically saying there's a God of Abraham, there's a God of the philosophers. That's a dig, right?
Probably, Rambam probably did not say
Nishmat
Kofar, right?
That feeling. Oh, we'll get there one second. We'll get there momentarily. But this is precisely... the critique, meaning Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz, you look in God, Man, and History, has this like, there's the encounter with God has to be there. Go home, you negative theologians. He's very harif about it. Franz Rosenzweig sings that necessarily in the Bali Masorah, but it also has a similar critique, but many others as well. But basically just say, listen, this notion of this picture of God is just not, doesn't allow for us to experience God.
It's supposed to be a relationship.
That's right. System. Now, the answer of the Rambam might be, and this was what Yishayahu Leibowitz, who loves this about the Rambam, would say, is, what relationship are you talking about? Mitzvos! That's all we have! I'm not sure that Leibowitz is right about the Rambam, but in other words, but there is a sense of saying that there are certain grand limits to human knowledge, and what we can say about what we can say we experience by God, and what we really know about God is just what He's told us to do. At the end of the day. Again, that relates to how you read 351 and 354. Whereas, but the limits of human knowledge are great. Now, Ginz asked the following point. Again, as I'm just pointing out here, the Rambam is a very problematic. And you start imagining yourself, what is the Rambam thinking when he's shuckling and says the, you know, the first brachot of Shemona Esrei? Or in general. Of course, this gets to the famous question about what the Rambam thinks about tefillah as a whole. I'm sure you're familiar with this famous passage, because korbanos, it seems to imply that the ultimate form of worship would just be meditation, right? Well, people always highlight the fact that the Rambam says, you know, implies at least, let me say it, but it implies that we won't have to pray in the future era. He also says we don't have to fast in the future era. I'm very into that notion. That part I'm like, I'm down with that. Anyway, prayer I like, fasting. What do you say? He mentions this, I don't know, yes. I'm saying, but no one's worried about Tana Esther.
Isn't that the one that's supposed to be like?
I know where you're getting at. I'm just saying, that's a later, Tana Esther is much later. It's only from Gaon. Anyway, okay.
It's a short day.
Anyway. Those of us who fasted and suffered on a Erev Shabbos fast. Painful, right? It's very difficult. Anyway, getting back to our thing. Now, Ginz asked the following question. But you understand the problem with tefillah now. The tefillah, relationship to God, feeling God's existence, you know, all these other tish type of things. In other words, no one gives a Friday night tish and says, Rabosai, we got to figure out, you got to know what you don't know. God can't be known. Right? No one gives such a dish. Yes. This Friday night, boys. There he goes.
Giving
it a mistake. So Ginz asked the following question. Here's, what would the Rambam do with all these piyutim that seem to talk about God? I think the class example is Anim Zemirot. It certainly includes...
A lot of people say not to say it.
We're saying, but if you take a look at 159, the Rambam has a lengthy critique of the poets who created piyutim, and he's like, this is terrible. This kind of license is frequently taken by poets and preachers as such as think that what they speak is poetry, so that the utterances of some of them constitute an absolute denial of faith, while other utterances contain such rubbish and such perverse imaginings as to make men laugh when they hear them on account of the nature of these utterances, and to make them weep when they consider that these utterances are applied to God, may be magnified and glorified.
But I'm not talking about something like...
Wait, one second. Yeah, one second, one second. No, you understand that critique? No. Say no, no. He's talking about the piyutim here. He's talking about the piyutim here.
Most of the piyutim written around his time, so it could be he doesn't have to contend. It wasn't written by Chazal, so he could just sing all that up.
Yeah, 100%.
Chazal, where he has to kind of work with the system.
You're correct. It's very easy to get rid of the paitanim. Oh yeah, there is. In general, the Rambam is not a big fan of poetry as a whole, and one of the reasons is that, and we'll discuss this when we get later on. But poetry is about sensuality, sensuousness. And the Rambam thinks sensuousness is the root of sin. But we'll talk about this another time. But part of the reason why also the Rambam doesn't like poets is that, and there is half of it's, you know, to quote a certain contemporary, well, I won't name, contemporary Poisek about English literature, which I don't agree with, but in any case, but he basically says, half it's Gilead Arias, half it's Avodah Zarah. Right? And I think that's the Rambam really basically feels about poetry in general, and certainly the Paitanim. It makes it worse. This is one thing what you do on the side, you know, on a Saturday night in the privacy when you sing poetry. It's another thing to put into the sitter. And that's why they burn the book, what can I tell you? I'm saying the Rambam has a rigorous critique of many aspects of what of his contemporary culture. Jewish culture, I'm talking about. Religious culture. And Paitanim are part of it. And his hero is Rabbi Chanina. Because Rabbi Chanina says, Azov! Right? Words, don't keep on trying to add these things, talking about God. And what's the response of these Paitanim, of course?
It's all figurative and it's...
Maybe not, but beyond that, I mean, that's probably true.
We're just following on what Chazal and Tanakh did.
A, and B, and you, Rambam, are creating a God that no one has a relationship to. We're the spirit of the soul. Now, off record, of course, the critique today of Paitanim is basically as follows. We say these piyutim, which range into halachic problems of adding into brachos or, you know, Shemoneh Esrei might be, or run into theological problems that the Rambam has on that side, and all the spiritual benefits no one gets anymore because no one understands what they mean. So understand the language. Right? That's sort of the critique of contemporary critique of Piyut. Even one of Shach. Either going to be like the philosophers and get rid of it, or the halachas and get rid of it, or you're going
to
be like the poets and keep it because they're meaning.
Well-versed in literature, even if you have the poetry in the language, it doesn't mean that you understand it.
That's right. So, Mimon of Shach, what are we saying this for? Yeah, that's why implicitly, by the way, the Maariv Chayes points this out. The Maariv Chayes, 19th century, points out, Maariv Chayes doesn't want to get rid of the piyutim, but he says over time they will be gotten rid of.
Happened.
And it has. Yeah, who's gotten rid of them all? No, that's why you can't get rid of them officially. Unofficially, you have to get rid of them.
They're in the back of the
city. The back of the city. Who got rid of them? The printers. The printers. Russia Yom Kippur, there's more. I'm saying, but every time a new sitter is printed, less and less are put in the beginning of it. Think about it. Take a look at the history of it. Take a look at the beauty of it. Right.
What
in Pesach night? No. Again. I mean, the Rambam. You can look. Well, you have to look at what the Rambam. You can see that Rambam's Haggadah. I mean, that's how you interpret some of these things. Keep in mind. I'm saying, keep in mind. You have to interpret. Things can be interpreted in a way in which they're not taken that manner. My point is to say as follows. But for the Rambam, there are many things, particularly post Chazal, which is no problem getting rid of. And Piyutim is in that category. There are other things that appear in Chazal which the Rambam gets rid of as well, like we talked about previously, like angels, or reinterprets.
Maybe you didn't believe in death struggle.
Don't go there. Anyway. All right, good stuff. This is good stuff for the Rambam. Now, in the coming weeks, we got to do some of this stuff here. Okay, so the coming weeks here, we're going to get into one of the stuff you just can't miss a little bit, which is as follows. What seems to be the best proof that God has attributes? I'm sorry? Yeah, but besides that, he's discussed that. God has different names. Why has God different names? Usually, people have different names because of the connotations of different aspects of who they are, whatever it might be. And in fact, normally it's how we interpret them. I'm sure you'll bring me Das Tvudos, who will explain to you all the different meanings of names.
He says,
think about this week. And what is different names and the 12-letter name, all these chazals, all these other things. So here the Rambam is going to get into this issue and therefore take a look in at least 160 to 164. Okay, take a look at 160 to 164, which again, we'll be meeting in 2 weeks next time. Next week, I'll be away.